Thanks for downloading the Overdrive podcast. Do not forget to follow us on Instagram at TSN1050, where there will be Insta stories, some best of clips from the show, and some very cool contest opportunities to win tickets and more. Again, on Instagram at TSN1050.
This is Overdrive on TSN 1050.
Big night in Toronto. Big night in Toronto. Duke is in town. The Whitecaps are in town. And Steve Simmons is in studio. What's the biggest story there?
The Canadian Championship is on the line.
That's right.
This has been...
Don't be sarcastic, Steve. This is big news.
That's not sarcasm. That's excitement, sort of.
Well, it means something.
This has been a horrible season for Toronto FC. Let's be honest.
No, it's been an absolute disaster. They may not make the playoffs.
Last year, my friend Curtis Larson, who's since left the Sun and gone into the new soccer league, called this the best team in the history of MLS. Best team ever, he wrote. Here we are with most of the same players 1 year later, fighting like heck to make the playoffs, and I'm not sure they will.
They have had injury problems, but every team suffers from injury problems. And when you're this deep and this loaded and the expectations are this high, to lose as many games as TFC has... they've been lucky a little bit because the Leafs and the Raptors have been so interesting throughout the summer months because of all the movement. Like in the front office with the Leafs and then the signing of Tavares, Casey out, Nurse in, and then the Kawhi trade. And the Blue Jays have been so bad, they've sucked up a lot of the negative energy. Like maybe that's what it is. We only have room to turn one team into a pinata. So you got to pick. And the Jays decided that they would be that team, so TFC kind of gets off the hook a little bit.
Well, go back to November. In November, the Argos win a Grey Cup that nobody saw coming. And even if you watch that game over and over and over, you can't figure out how in heck they won, but they won. And they had that championship. And then right after they had that championship, TFC wins. And so Larry Tannenbaum, who hadn't won anything in his life, suddenly has two championships in like a matter of weeks. And all of us, and then the Raptors are on a record-breaking season. The Leafs are on a record-breaking season. You know, let's throw playoffs out for a minute, and you see the kind of summers with Kawhi Leonard coming. I mean, the biggest player movement other than LeBron James in either sport, two players landed in Toronto. So this is the summer of all kinds of things happening. And the Argos have kind of blown up, and TFC has kind of blown up, and
the Jays have just been,
you know, dreadful almost start to finish, really.
12-5 start.
Although it's funny now, it's nice now to sort of see some of the kids that you're going to see in the future, hoping that this group actually can play.
Yeah.
And I never judge anyone in a game or 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
No, it's not enough sample size. And like Danny Jansen hit a home run last night. That was a really cool scene. Hit a couple hits his first outing. Sean Reed Foley was okay. Looks like he's got some pretty good stuff. I think they expect him to be a member of the rotation next year. I don't think the ceiling is a top two guy in anyone's rotation, but a depth guy you can get some innings out of and get some stuff out of, and you've got him under team control for a long time. I do think some of the excitement is taken away from these kids simply because of the Vladdy Guerrero story and because they're not Vladdy Guerrero. Like, even a guy like Bo Bichette, who's having a pretty good season, he's 20 years old, he's a highly touted guy. Baseball America just ranked him fifth. Fifth. When was the last time the Jays had the fifth best rated prospect in baseball?
Maybe never.
Maybe never. I mean, I don't know.
Lloyd Mosby probably way, way back when he was the second pick in the draft.
Like, we'd have to go way back. I don't think Sanchez ever got up that high. I don't think Stroman ever got up that high.
Not even close.
Syndergaard, when he was in the organization, was ever that high.
Maybe a Delgado, depending on where he was in the minors. I don't remember his minor league career. He just came here and kind of exploded.
Right. So you've got Bo Bichette, fifth best prospect in baseball. And he is not even in the conversation because of what Vladdy Guerrero represents.
Well, to me, it's not just what he represents. Have you watched what Ronald Acuna Jr. is doing in Atlanta?
Mm-hmm.
He said five in a row now? Five home runs to start games in a row in a pennant race of some kind. And Juan Soto in Washington, 19 years old, tearing it up with the Washington Nationals. And Vladdy Guerrero, before this season, was rated right with those guys, right with Acuna.
That would be a great poll. Poll the 30 GMs in baseball anonymously and get them to rank who they would take. Who would you take? because I kind of get the impression, even though Vladdy hasn't taken a hack in the major leagues, Vladdy would be the first one off the board because of his power, because of the slugging.
I think the hitter, if you're judging only for hitting, and what Acuna's done lately is crazy great.
Right.
If you're judging only for hitting, I think Vladdy would be the choice. But in the case of Soto, and more so in the case of Acuna, is you've got a guy who's a great outfielder, and you got a guy who's making these circusy kind of catches. And so there's a few more elements to his game, which is why probably he was rated ahead of Guerrero, you know, at one time not that long ago.
Also a year older than him, and was likely to get to the majors quicker because of that.
Look what baseball has right now with these kids. I mean, there is a group of kids like we've never seen. Like, who made the majors at 19 or 20? You know, the odd,
very rarely.
Odd guy years ago.
Very rarely.
But we're seeing it in every sport. You see it with NFL quarterbacks. Used to be the five-year wait. Now guys come in and play right away.
It's money. That's what's changed. Money. These kids get paid.
But the baseball's not about money because you don't get paid in the early
years. That's the point. There's more of an emphasis to take advantage of them on the cheap. Like, that is, I think, what it is. Because the money goes both ways. In football, it was because you were paying the rookie quarterback so much money, you had to play him. You took a kid first overall, and he was getting $50 million guarantee, like Sam Bradford or Matt Stafford. You had to play him. You're not going to sit him on the bench. Where the reverse in baseball is, and hockey. Hockey, it's most prominent because it's 3 years, and you know what you're getting for the first 3 years. There's no arbitration. It doesn't move up. It's the exact same number outside of bonus incentives if they hit it. And you know exactly what you're getting for the first 3 years.
But outside,
so you got to take advantage.
Outside of the McDavids and the Matthews and those kind of teenagers, there hasn't been a lot of teenagers who've come in and lit it up in the NHL.
There's three on the Leafs on entry-level deals. Three.
Yeah, but they weren't. But, like, for example, Marner went back to junior.
For a year.
Nylander went back to the AHL.
Yeah.
There were some development. They didn't come in immediately the one and done's do in basketball.
But they don't do that in baseball either. No, like, the first overall pick doesn't walk into the majors.
That's what makes this so incredible.
But they still had a year or two.
Historically, it used to be 5 years in the minors.
Right. No,
rookies would be 22 and 23. That's when guys would be coming in, which I think is about the age of Jansen and Reed Foley and those guys. They're about that age. So they're coming in now, which is sort of the normal, you know, they've gone rookie ball to A ball to high A to double A to the short stints in triple, although Jansen was in triple all year. You know, that kind of thing is different than what we're seeing with, I mean, Vladdy went, you know, he's been on fast track this year.
Well, everyone knows, everybody knows, the only reason he's not here is because of service time. That's it. They can't even pretend.
Well, they value his service time clearly more than they value these other guys that they're now calling up.
Well, yes, for sure, because they know what they've got in Vladdy. They don't know if Sean Reed Foley's going to be here in 7 years or Danny Jansen in 7 years. But Vladdy's such a different example because of the way that he's hitting and what he projects to be. Anything short of a superstar is a disappointment. Like, think about that. How many times have we had that in this city?
That's a tough place. John Olerud kind of had that. John Olerud came in with no minor league experience. The Blue Jays signed him when he said he wouldn't. He was going to college. He wasn't going to come. And they promised him a spot on the roster immediately. And you know, it took him a while to sort of find his legs and get everything going the way he could. And he wasn't a superstar. He was a very good MLB player. You know,
won a batting title.
Won a batting title. I think his career OPS is in the 860. So we're, you know, talking about a really good major league player.
Yeah.
But not a guy that's, you know, going to change the world or go to the Hall of Fame. You know, Vladdy is already sort of ticketed to be that kind of hitter.
Right, exactly. You know, in this city, outside of Matthews, I can't think of anyone else, even anybody that the Raptors have ever taken. Vince Carter was not expected to be a guarantee superstar.
No, not at all. In fact, they didn't draft Vince Carter.
No, I know that. It was Jameson, but still, it's the same thing. Yeah, it was a draft night deal.
They were shocked by how good Vince Carter was.
Right. Chris Bosh, in a really deep draft, they thought he'd be very good. Superstar? I don't know. I don't know if they thought superstar.
I don't think he was a superstar. I think he was a very good NBA player.
He's going to the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Chris Bosh will go to the Hall of Fame.
In basketball, everybody goes to the Hall of Fame.
I guess it depends on the definition of superstar based on the sport. But I guess what we're alluding to is what I'm alluding to is there have been, in my lifetime, there was nobody until the past 2 years, and now we've got two. Where Matthews, anything short of him being a superstar would be a disappointment, and anything short of Vladdy Guerrero Jr. being a superstar would be a disappointment.
So let
like
that,
a star, a good player, very good player. Sorry, not going to cut it. We need more than that.
Let's add two possible names to that list as well. Or maybe three, depending on how long he lasts. One is Kawhi Leonard, who already is a superstar, many would say, a probably sure thing at this point in time, sure thing Hall of Famer. In most people's minds, anywhere from top three to top 10 in the NBA as a player. He's coming in. It may only be 1 year. You know, who knows? I'm waiting for my teletext to come in to tell me.
Eventually, you know, it'll get here.
You know, what exactly the message is. John Tavares has not played with the kind of support he's going to play with this season. I've always thought he was a superb NHL player. I want to find, sometimes you can be that guy when you're the guy on the team and everything revolves around you. What happens now when you're the guy and not everything revolves around you? And I still want to see what Mitch Marner is going to be. Like, Mitch Marner wants to be. I know what he wants to be.
I think he has the ability to be a superstar in the league. I didn't place the same expectation as I did with Matthews and now with Vladdy, but I was close. I've always been a huge supporter of his talents and what I believe he can bring.
I've never put Marner and Matthews in the same sentence. I just look at them differently. Maybe because one is a center and one isn't. And now let's go back to game 40 of last season and project from game 40 to the end of the season through the 7 games against Boston and ask yourself in those games when Matthews played. You know, he was hurt for 20 of those. But when Matthews played and in the playoffs, who was the better player? It was Mitch Marner.
Yeah, he was a more effective player, for sure. I mean, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden you're the better player.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying right now,
what you saw is what you're saying.
It's the old, you know, Kane-Taves thing of Chicago.
Well, I think that could be up for debate. I mean, I would say that I believe that Matthews has more offensive talent than Jonathan Toews ever has.
Oh, there's no question.
So, now, Toews is an all-around brilliant player, great two-way guy, kills penalties, leader, all that kind of stuff. And Matthews has to grow in a lot of different areas where Toews has owned it. But in terms of the offensive ability of Patrick Kane compared to Toews, I think everyone, including the two of them, and anyone affiliated with the organization, going back to when they were both drafted, would say Kane's got more offensive upside.
And yet when they were winning Stanley Cups, you could argue that Toews was as valuable, if not more valuable, than Kane.
You don't win without both of them. You need both. If it's just one on their own, I don't think they win three cups. I'm not sure they win one cup. With both of them, you get the three cups. Now, you got to throw in Duncan Keith and Seabrook and goaltending and Quinville, etc. But I do think, from an offensive perspective, simply putting up numbers, Mitch Marner has the ability to put up more points than Matthews. Now, does that mean he's a better all-around player? I'm not sure his position will allow for that.
Do you ever read the hockey forecaster that comes out before the season?
I've read it before, yeah.
It's one of my favorite, I hate to say, one of my favorite toilet books, because you can sit down and pick up any page you want and look
That's great.
Players. And they tell you, or they at least predict the points, the goals and assists of every player coming to the season.
Yeah.
And they had Matthews this year leading the Leafs with 44 goals. And they had Tavares behind him in points, way down in goals, and they had Marner 1 point ahead of both of them with 85 points.
Probably 65 assists.
Yeah, I think it was 22 and something. Mm-hmm. Whatever it was, I just found it interesting that that's how they chose to sort of...
Well, that is the beauty of the overflowing of talent and potential for offensive production with this team. Is I've had these conversations, I'm sure you have too. You're in hockey pools. When the hockey pools come around, and they're coming around quick, it's August 15th, isn't it? I mean, we're in camp in less than a month. The season begins in 48 or 49 days. So over the next 40 to 45 days, fantasies are going to be starting up. Who are you taking? What's your 1-2-3 on the Leafs?
I think I would go Matthews, Marner, Tavares. That would be my...
I think I would as well. If it's just simply points, if it, not a rotisserie league, because that changes everything, but simply points, I think I'd go Matthews 1. But he, I think, brings more risk because of the injury problems he had a year ago.
Well, we don't know. See, we've had 2 years of the guy. And we've seen him at his absolute best and what he can do when he's at his absolute best. And he is just a dominant monster at that stage. But we've also seen him hurt a little bit too much. And you miss 20 games. And we've seen it with other players, other big guys have been hurt, and then they consistently are hurt. Is he going to be a guy who misses 15, 20 games a year?
Well,
I sure hope not.
When he was playing in Switzerland, he had some injury problems.
So we don't know if he is susceptible to injuries or, you know, different people. There's the Phil Kessel guys who play, who never get hurt, who never put themselves in a position to get hurt.
But still, if you're playing, Jake Gardner's the best example of that. Gardner plays every single night.
The Sedins, 80 games, 81 games, 82 games, every single year.
I place a lot of value in that.
Oh, I think there's tremendous value in that. And so we don't know yet. After 2 years, you can't tell what Austin Matthews is that way. But you know, I found it an interesting exercise. I don't know if you've done this or even been asked to do it. Are you on the top 50 list?
Yes, I am. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago.
And to sit down and try and, where do I put Matthews? Where do I put Tavares? Where do I put, or is Marner in the top
50? Marner's in my top 50, he is.
He was, but I found it real difficult to place three of them.
I think the more difficult exercise when it comes to the Leafs in the top 50 is, would Freddie Anderson be included?
He wasn't on mine. But I have very few goalies on mine.
See, that comes down to bias and how you feel about the position and trying to define the position. Where I'm sure if you talk to Noodles, Noodles probably has 8 goalies in his top 50 players in the league.
Here's the thing. A few years ago, and it wasn't last year, but I think within the last 2 years, I had Carey Price in the top 5.
So did I.
And to me, he was the only goalie who changed games completely. And he had a bad year last year. So I'm looking now, like, where do you place Carey Price?
He's got to be in the top 50.
He's in the top 50. I'm saying, but he dropped from me from about 5 to somewhere maybe 20, 25.
Right.
And then you're thinking, okay, who's the next guy? Who's the next best goalie in the
NHL? Well, the Vezina winner, the last time we saw him, the guy was an absolute disaster.
Well, I couldn't put him on there. I couldn't find a place.
You don't have Pekka Rinne in your top 50.
Did not have a
place. So the reigning Vezina Trophy winner is not in the top 50
players. And Sergei Bobrovsky, who was the one before him, I think, was not on the list either.
Oh, Bob! I would have Bob in the top. I will have him in the top 50.
Here's the problem. I kept putting guys and then looking at the other goalies and thinking...
You know. But here's the problem with that exercise, is that Hellebuck and Vasilevsky, we've seen them once.
See, Hellebuck,
they played 1 year.
But you're projecting for the coming year.
I understand that.
So are you looking back or are you looking forward?
Either way, you've got 1 year of material to really be able to tell.
I had Hellebuck in there. There's something about his eyes.
It's, oh, really?
What? Yeah. He's got those sort of crazed eyes. He looks like if you ever put him in a movie... He looks like the guy that could be like, you know, 11 people were shot dead.
He doesn't look like he's a guy that you're dying to go for a beer with.
Yeah.
He doesn't scream personality, a lot of goalies have that kind of vibe.
But I think there's something about that team. And
Winnipeg?
They're
loaded.
I had Mark Scheifele very high.
I would have him high. I'd have Laine very high. I'd have Wheeler high.
I had Wheeler higher than Laine, but I had me. Scheifele was the number one guy from that team.
Sure.
But I had Hellebuck. And I had Price, and I'm not sure who else. Oh, I had Fleury.
You had Marc-Andre Fleury.
Yeah.
We're projecting here, though,
yes.
Steve. Again, this is a guy who's had a lot of concussion problems.
Yes.
Has had a bit of a roller coaster career in terms of production.
I like that team. I like that
operation. Still like Vegas.
I like the way they play. And I think they've got a lot going on.
I am not convinced that carries over. I doubted them all year up until Game 6 of a Cup Final, but I can't imagine they replicate their success.
I'm not saying they're going to replicate their success, but you don't go 4 games against the LA Kings and 5, whatever it was. It was 4-5-4.
They barely lost. They went to 6 against San Jose, I think.
But they were in control of all of those games. And they were in control in some of the games they didn't win against the Washington Capitals. They didn't have a great series. They didn't even have a good series. And maybe, you know, there's a possibility that they'll fall back and not be a top 8 team. But I saw what Fleury meant in that community, and I saw what he meant to those guys. And sometimes guys find themselves in a new spot. And I had him, I think, 49th.
Okay, so he just broke the top 50.
Yeah. I had to put Rasmus Dahlin in at 50.
You have Dahlin in there in the top 50.
It's that one highlight film
that
they show over and over and over. You know what I'm talking about?
I've seen a bunch of them.
Everyone's seen that one
like
where he dekes around like 9 people and then scores.
I don't think I'll have Dahlin in the top 50, but every other first overall pick, although Nico Hischier this year wouldn't have been considered a top 50 player.
And I didn't have him in this year either.
No, nor he doesn't deserve to be. But there's been some good first overall picks. Steve Phillips will join us in about 10 minutes on Danny Jansen, what he saw out of Sean Reed Foley a couple of nights ago, some other stories in baseball, including Boston, who just, they never lose. The Red Sox never lose. And one of the most peculiar explanations for a player going on the concussion protocol list you're ever going to hear. And, of course, it has to do with Manziel. We'll tell you about that next. So, Johnny Manziel did not practice yesterday. And then today, the media shows up and once again, he wasn't out there on the field. And yesterday, Mike Sherman just came out with the most ridiculous explanation for why he wasn't there yesterday, that they had a pre-arranged blood work scheduled, as if he couldn't do that at night, in the morning, before practice, at the facility. So immediately, you don't have to be a journalist. You didn't have to go to Columbia to figure this out. Something's up. And then Manziel isn't on the field again today. And the LOS decided to release a statement. Now, because it's in Montreal, the first half is in French. I'm not going to read that. The second half is in English. You try to explain what the hell this means. Okay, Steve? On Tuesday morning, Johnny Manziel mentioned to our medical staff that he felt symptoms that could be associated with the prescribed medication he uses for a previously diagnosed medical condition. He then missed practice in order to have some blood work done. In view of the hit he received on Saturday and the potential mitigating side effects of his prescribed medication, the Alouettes medical staff has placed Manziel under the CFL concussion protocol for further observation and precautionary reasons. What the hell does that mean?
It means Johnny Manziel suffered a concussion in the last game, and we're not going to give you the satisfaction of telling you that.
So instead, we're going to pretend like it has something to do with a drug that he was prescribed about that pertains to a completely different medical issue.
I love the blood work part of the story myself.
Yes.
And as a diabetic, I get blood work rather often. For the time you go into the lab to the time you go out of the lab, assuming that you don't line up, because you would think Johnny Manziel wouldn't have to line up. I'm sure they have a protocol where they jump the queue. It's about a 15-minute process. So you do that in the morning before your meetings? Do you do it the night before?
But also, yesterday they said it was a pre-scheduled blood work appointment. Well, like they gave off this impression that prior to the trade they had this booked. Like he flew back to Hamilton to get the blood work done. Well, because it was at McMaster Hospital that he actually had this thing set up.
Maybe because of his previous problems and maybe some of the drugs he's on to deal with, you know, any of the issues he might have, maybe he needs to do blood work to deal with that on a regular basis. That's a possibility too, but that would not or should not
affect his ability
to play and or practice.
Never in a million years.
The CFL is going through a funny thing right now, and I'm finding this not just in Montreal. I'm finding it kind of across the board. Nobody can give you a straight answer to anything. Daron Carter, they let him go in Saskatchewan. Daron Carter might be the most athletic player in the CFL. He might be the best player, actual physical. If you're going to rate a football player, who's a better football player than him? Why was he released? I don't have a freaking clue. Like, I don't know.
And Chris Jones just refused to give an answer.
He kept answering, but his answer sounded like the Montreal Alouettes statement. Like, blah, 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 yeah. blah. And we hope
that's the world we live in now.
We hope no one's willing to say anything. Enough to believe it.
Yeah, the Manziel stuff is just absurd. And I'll say this, too. What I have concluded is Mike Sherman, the head coach in Montreal, he will not be the head coach for long. Because when you become a human pinata, you don't survive. Like we saw it with Peter Horacek when he was here in Toronto. We saw it with Ben McAdoo, the head coach of the Giants recently. Remember Ron Rolston in Buffalo, the Sabres, where he wore gardening gloves out on the ice?
Some guys just don't look like they should be in charge.
If you become a human pinata and you're not taken seriously and people don't have respect for anything you say or anything you do, it's just a matter of time before you're out. And I hate to break it to Mike Sherman, but I'm pretty sure that's what's happening in Montreal right now.
Strange thing has happened with the Montreal Alouettes from the moment Mark Trestman left. They have been determined to find another American who can come in and succeed in the CFL, which has historically not been an easy thing for guys who haven't been in the league to do. Usually your best head coaches come from guys who've either played in the league or been around the league long enough to become that. So they went through, I forget the guy's name now, who came in immediately after Trestman, and he was a disaster. And then I think they brought somebody else in, and he was a disaster. Now they got Mike Sherman there, and he's got a decent reputation. Mike Sherman has historically been a good football coach in the United States. But being a good football coach in the United States and being a good head football coach in the CFL really are two completely different things. And you know, you're right, though. Once you become, the Argos have had it a few times. They had Bart Andrus. They've had a few of those guys you looked at. Within 5 minutes, you could see, you don't belong.
Wasn't going to cut it. Yeah, people are going to turn on you.
And you know what? Peter Horacek's about as nice a guy as you're ever going to meet when you sit down. I've had dinner with him a few times.
He was a victim of the circumstances as well. It was, they had their sights on Babcock. Shanahan was turning everything over. The city had turned on that team and that core. It didn't really matter what he did, but did become a guy who was an easy whipping boy.
But once in a while, that guy comes in who's the interim, and he's so impressive as the interim, or he does it so well that he gets kept on or gets hired somewhere else because of the job he did in that short circumstance. And you can see it when a guy comes in and he's got that. I hate the term "it factor," but coaches need to have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of assistant coaches out there that are fine at teaching and fine at doing, but none of them can be head coaches.
Well, it's also a very different role, right? When you're the man, it's very different. When you have no one to answer to but the GM and the owner, you can have a very different disposition and a very different approach. We saw that on Hard Knocks, which we don't get up here, but the first episode of Hard Knocks, there was a bit of a battle between Todd Haley, the offensive coordinator with the Browns, and Hugh Jackson, the head coach of the Browns. And Haley was pushing for something to happen, and Jackson said, "I appreciate your point. I used to have the same thought process when I was in your shoes, but now that I'm the head coach, I have a very different view." And you got to have the stones to be able to say that as well, and know that whatever you say is the last thing that's going to be said, and what's actually going to take into account or be taken into account by all the players, and by extension, the media and the fans, and you're the voice box for everything.
There's no
you're the messenger. Okay.
There's no definition of presence. But when you see it, you know it exists. And we see it over and over again. When you see Joel Quenneville, you know he has presence. Maybe his assistants don't, but he has presence, and he is the guy in charge. You can go through. Scotty Bowman had presence. Mike Babcock has presence. You can go through different people. Some guys naturally have it. Some guys don't naturally have it.
And in Toronto, we'll find out with Nick Nurse come September when camp opens up. Does Nick Nurse have it? Does he have that presence?
Well, I think one of the reasons people don't adore Cito Gaston, one, two World Series, he should be, you know, on posters everywhere and statues and everything else. Didn't have presence. Didn't have that natural ability to communicate to the public, to communicate to his team. Didn't have that.
Right.
He had a different style, and it worked successfully and fantastic for him. But you would never, and I think that's one of the reasons he never got credit other places. Because he didn't have that.
Duke is in town again tonight. They will be playing Ryerson, the Ryerson Rams tonight. Jay Billis is going to have the call on ESPN. Jay will join us just after 5 p.m. Steve Phillips, our Jays analyst and MLBN insider, will join us in 2 minutes. Jay Billis of ESPN just after 5. He's in town calling the Duke Ryerson Rams game tonight. RJ Barrett, who's from Toronto, is in town, expected to play tonight. We'll get his take on that. The Vancouver Whitecaps are in town for the final leg of the Canadian Championship down at BMO. And Alphonso Davies, he's here, not sure if he's going to play tonight. And for Canadian soccer, you kind of need it. You need him in these moments. You need to create some sort of a buzz around this kid. He's 17, 18 years old. He's going over to Bayern Munich. They had him over in Moscow during the World Cup, unveiling the 2026 bid. He was there representing Canada and CONCACAF, and we'll try to get you an update on his status later in the afternoon. Jay's back in action in Kansas City tonight with a win last night. Danny Jansen went deep. Chat about it. We're joined now by our TSN analyst, Steve Phillips. What's up, Steve?
Hey, guys. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. Let's begin with Danny Jansen. He had a couple of hits his first outing. He went deep last night. Small sample size, but based on what you've seen, what you've heard, what do you think the Jays might have here?
Yeah, I like Danny Jansen. I like his setup behind the plate. I like the way he receives the ball. I liked how he you know, obviously he had a couple breaking pitches from Reed Foley that, you know, were, you know, 58-footers that he had to try to do what he could to block. But I like how he moves. He's got a strong arm. He's got good feet behind the plate. Short, quick stroke. And, you know, what I like about him is he's a contact hitter. He's not a swing-and-miss guy. You know, his strikeouts and walks are always pretty close from year to year. And, you know, we don't see many players like that anymore. In that, you know, we see guys swinging for the fences with the launch angle to try to drive the ball, but he still showed some power as well. I've been really impressed by him so far, and obviously, you know, the relationship with the young pitchers, guys that he's known, guys he's grown up with, guys that are his good buddies, it's nice to watch that as well. And I think what I do like is the Jays, you know, and I always try to do this. If I call the young guy up, I want to set him up to succeed. So I want him to have been playing well down in the minor leagues, and I want to set him up in a matchup where maybe they can have some success early on. And I think playing them against the Royals was a really good idea.
And yet, watching Reed Foley, it's the first time I've ever seen him, I'll confess, watching him against a rather wonky Kansas City lineup, I don't know how hot it was that night, Steve, but I've never seen a guy sweat more. It looked like someone poured water over his jersey in that game.
Yeah, I was sweating watching him. But it can get hot in Kansas City now, that's for sure. But he was a bit hyped up. And that was going to be the challenge that you know, when he came to spring training, you know, they saw a guy trying to do too much, over trying. He didn't quite have the fastball velocity, and he didn't command his fastball. And you could see him every once in a while trying to really reach back and get a little bit extra on it. What I did like, though, is he has some really good late life, you know, where you see the ball just as it gets to the plate, have that little bit of giddy up, that little bit of hop into the batter's box. Now, he didn't always command it, and you know, he kept coming in, down and into the left-handed hitters. I would have liked him to be able to go with that fastball down and away at times to the left-hander, but I liked his guts to be able to pitch inside. Not only throw inside, but to try to throw a strike inside. And so I think there's a lot to work with there with him, and I did really like the life on his fastball. He threw some pretty good sliders, but now he's just got to take a deep breath, calm down a little bit. And I thought Gibbons did a nice job, because I thought when he had bases loaded, walked in the run, I thought, you know what, here comes the hook. And they left him in to get out of that inning, which I was really amazed by, to send him back out again. And I thought it was an excellent job of managing the moment with a young pitcher, that giving him that little bit of extra rope, he got out of it rather than yanking him out of the game and going to the bullpen and not really knowing how he could have handled it. So I thought it was a pretty special moment.
Yeah, it does feel like that'll be a part of the conversation over the final 40 or so games, the way Gibbons handles the kids, right? Like how much rope he decides to give them. The kind of positioning he puts them in, where he hits them in the lineup, how many pitches he gives them, how many innings he gives them. I'm with you on the Reed Foley moment. Why not? We interviewed him yesterday, and he said that meant a lot to him, the fact that Gibbons would give him that opportunity. And that's really what you need out of Gibbons. Like, I don't care what John Gibbons says to Kendrys Morales right now. Like, what do I care? Is Solarte or Diaz? It's really about the kids. I mean, if there's one thing Gibbons can do before he's out, and I think we all expect he's going to be gone in a month and a half, is try to set up these kids on the right path so that they can be successful in the future.
Yeah, and there's no question Gibby will do that. Here's the thing. Like, I go back a long way. I played in the minor leagues with John Gibbons. He signed in 1980 with the Mets. I signed in 81. We played in instructional league together. We were in spring training together. I hired him when I was running the minor leagues for the Mets as a minor league coach and manager and roving catching instructor. He has a player development background. He's got great empathy and understanding about what it's like. He hasn't forgotten how tough the game is. He hasn't forgotten the journey and the path and the road that players take to get to the major leagues. And he understands what it feels like when guys first get there. So I think he's going to do a really nice job in, you know, conjunction with the front office to listen to what they want, to talk to the young man and try to get them in moments to be able to try to figure out what they can do. I think Gibby will handle this last month plus extremely well and in the best interest of the Blue Jays organization moving forward.
It may be premature to say this, but could you see a starting rotation next year of Stroman, Sanchez, Baraki, and Reed Foley, and now you add in whatever pitcher you happen to either from your own system or that you go out and use all the money you're getting back from Estrada and Jay Happ?
Well, I think you can. I would like to protect the young guys and not necessarily just say, okay, this is what we're going with, because, you know, they're still going to be young, and here's what I expect. Out of young pitchers, I think it's only fair to expect, at best, fifth starter performance. They're going to give you a 7 1/3 inning, 3-hit, 1-run game, but it will possibly and maybe likely be followed by a 2 2/3 inning clunker, and it's the same guy. And I'm going to look at him exactly the same way. It's just the nature of being young and trying to figure out consistency. And how do I, if I don't feel great, how do I pitch today at the big league level? When I make a mistake, what do they do with it? And if I don't have my command of my fastball, how do I survive? That it's different in the major leagues than in the minor leagues. So I'd rather have some built-in protection with some veteran experience in the midst to where the veterans can get a little bit of room to grow early, and then the kids step in instead of the kids going in there, getting it handed to them, going back to the minor leagues, and then you're going to that next level of depth of guys who might not be quite ready. So I think that I could see some turns through the rotation with all four of those guys you mentioned being part of it. I just don't want to go in with that being the plan right from the start.
With Steve Phillips here on Overdrive, I was reading, I believe it was the power rankings earlier today, and it's very subjective, and a lot of it, you just move teams around to prove that you're actually doing something week in, week out. But they had Boston, New York, Cleveland, Houston as the top four teams in all of baseball. Would you dispute that at all? Do you think the four best teams are all in the American League?
Yeah, I do. I would think that that's accurate. I really do. I think... it's amazing. Like, people in New York are crushing the Yankees right now. They've got the second best record in baseball. Like, they're 31 games over 500, and people are mad. Wow, we don't have the depth we need and everything else. And I'm like, yeah, everybody else, you've got first world problems. You've got rich people problems in New York right now. But I do. I think that between the Yankees, Red Sox, Indians, and Astros, they are the best teams. I think that they've got, even if they have some levels of weakness, their strengths are so strong that they can compensate for that. Where I think, Atlanta and Philadelphia in the National League are just young teams still figuring it out. The Cubs starting pitching is really scuffling at the end of the game. I don't love for them. Milwaukee's got some flaws in their rotation right now and defensively. And Arizona, Colorado, and the Dodgers, it's a battle of three flawed teams trying to see which one wins the division and who ultimately settles into that wild card. So, yeah, I really do. I think the American League, whoever it is that goes to the World Series out of the American League, will be a significant favorite over whoever comes out of the National League.
Steve, Brian and I were talking a little earlier in the show about Vladdy Guerrero Jr. and the young players in baseball right now. And we're looking at what Ronald Acuna Jr. is doing with the Atlanta Braves, and we're looking at what Soto is doing with Washington Nationals. And I'm figuring that somewhere in between Acuna and Soto is where Vladdy will fit, or maybe even ahead of them as hitters going forward.
Yeah, I have him ahead of them going forward. Now, the one thing that Soto does that Acuna Jr. doesn't do yet is he walks. I mean, when you look at the difference between those two players and their numbers right now, I mean, Soto, it doesn't strike out a lot, and he walks a lot. And that really separates him. Soto right now, when you look at his production overall, I mean, he's a guy right now who's got a 970 OPS, 54 walks, 59 strikeouts. Now, the funny thing is, like, right now, Acuna has five more at-bats than Soto does, but Soto has, 35 more plate appearances. In those 35 plate appearances, he walked, where Acuna hasn't had the at-bat yet. And so that's the big difference between the two of them. They're two really special guys. But I think Vladimir Guerrero Jr., I don't think he's going to strike out a lot. I think his numbers will be more like Soto's numbers. And I think his power is going to be beyond Soto as well. So I do. I think he's going to step in like these young guys and immediately be an elite-level offensive player.
Thank you, Steve. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Steve Phillips, our Jays analyst. So he'd take Vladdy over the other two.
Just like what we were talking before, I think we would all take him for offense. Mm-hmm. We don't know what kind of defensive player he is yet. We know what Acuna Jr. is defensively, and I don't have them watched Soto enough to have a book either way on him that way. But I'm one of these guys that I equate offense and defense.
I'm a big
believer that half the time you spend on the field counts as much as your time at the plate.
Oh, I don't agree with that at all. I mean, I don't think their defensive play is anywhere close to the value that they bring at the plate. But it means something. Like, I don't think it's 50-50. You're not suggesting it's 50-50.
No, I'm just suggesting one can be as important as the other, depending on how your team can succeed.
Depending on the moment,
yeah,
for sure. But if you're healthy and you're getting a certain amount of plate appearances every year, compared to you playing left field, how many balls are going to get hit to you over the course of a season compared to the amount of plate appearances, the ratio is pretty far off.
I wonder what that number would be, because say you're up four times a game. That's sort of the average, right?
Four or five.
4 to 5, depending on where you hit in the lineup. But say four. Are you seeing four balls, you know, at third base a game? Probably not necessarily, but
no,
in that,
I wouldn't think on average. Like on average, like top of the lineup guys are getting what, 600 plate appearances a year, 650, something like that. If you're playing left field, there's no way you're getting 600 hits your way.
No,
there's no way
that
you're
would be five.
Hits.
It'd be basically five a game.
Exactly, yeah, it's not happening.
No,
so. You know, there's value in it. I don't dispute that. But if your numbers offensively are so extremely above and beyond what anyone else is supplying, then I'm not even sure when you take into consideration the defensive flaws, if there are any.
Well, I think what you do take into consideration are the exceptional plays, because the exceptional plays can win you games in the field. And that's, I guess, how many of those do you make? When do you make them? When do they come? How do they work?
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is what we tend to not talk nearly enough about. Historically, the Hall of Fame doesn't look much at defense. You know, we're looking for all-stars. We don't care much about defense.
Although it is wrapped into wins above replacement.
Yeah.
Like war stats do take into effect defensive proficiency.
Yeah, but
most of the
defensive proficiency stats, to me, have been flawed so far because they're subjective. And what's a play you should make? How do you determine whether it's a play you should make? I'll use Roberto Alomar as an example. He's one of the greatest baseball players I've ever watched. Definitely the greatest Blue Jay. And he made plays all the time that were just outs. And I don't know how they would be quantified in fielding kind of statistics comparatively. And if you look back, his fielding statistics are not terrific based on today's metrics. And the fact that they're not terrific leads me to believe that today's metrics and he still needs some tweaking.
You're going to piss people off with those takes, Steve.
You know what?
You're going to rattle cages,
hey,
man.
Listen, Dave Winfield, Hall of Famer Dave Winfield, won the World Series for the Jays in 92 with his double down the line. He was on the other day, and he was talking about when it comes off the bat. Launch angles.
Like velocity. Exit velocities
and all those things.
Well, exit velocity is one.
The Yankees are killing the Red Sox in exit velocity.
Well, did you see this stat over the weekend? I don't know. I need to read more into this, how they can define this. But according to exit velocity, Giancarlo Stanton hit the fastest home run in the history of baseball. But that's how it was labeled. Like, this was the quickest home run in history in terms of off the bat, out of the park. And my reaction to that was, I don't dispute that it was incredibly quick, but you saw every home run Babe Ruth hit, and that was,
yeah.
You found a way. How did you quantify how, you know, what Ty Cobb was doing, or Babe Ruth, or Hank Aaron, or
they have mathematical equations to do that. And I agree with you. The statistics are great, and they tell you things, and they work in some ways, but Dave Winfield was talking on the weekend that they were honoring the 92-3 Blue Jays.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, not enough people are teaching hitters to hit line drives anymore.
Well,
line drives will still find the places through shifts. And he said he believes that learning to hit line drives was why he became such a great hitter. And he
different eras, yeah, right? It's a very different era.
He had no use for, because someone made a joke about what was your exit velocity, and he kind of went off on that as well.
Old school Goose Gossage type yelling at the clouds. Like, that's what it is, Steve.
I don't think it's yelling at the clouds. I think there's cases to be made for a little bit of each.
You see, like a lot of guys today with the shift, like Wade Boggs was tweeting about it recently. It's like, just slap one down the third baseline. Like, that's what I would do.
But Wade Boggs could do it.
He could do it, but that's the thing. Guys are not trained to do it.
You know?
Exactly. Jay Billis will join us just after 5 p.m. It's a big night in Toronto. Duke playing Ryerson. R.J. Barrett will be in the building tonight. We'll get Jay's take on R.J. Barrett as a prospect going forward. Overdrive continues on the TSN app.
The greatest moments in history are now up to you. This is TSN 1050's Sound Wars.
Yeah! All right, so day two of the Ultimate Championship Sound Wars battle. We know that the last year's reigning champ was one of my most hated clips. One clip that I would really, truly love to just wash away forever. Do you want to revisit that, Steve?
I've heard it.
You've heard it many times, I'm sure.
And I'm sure it's been played. I don't know.
Well, let's hear it one more time.
The first pick goes to the Maple Leafs.
The Toronto Maple Leafs.
The Leafs.
The Leafs.
They did it, Naylor.
They did it, Naylor. That'll be around forever. That'll be on my tombstone.
That's your touch it all Joe moment.
That is. Yeah, that's my Tom Cheek. Step aside, Tom Cheek. They did it, Naylor, is the one of the great radio moments in the history of the city.
You know, would it have been as good as, like, they did it, MacArthur?
No, Naylor's, it just rolls off the tongue. Yeah, that'll be on my tombstone. They did it, Naylor. Here lies an idiot that once yelled out, they did it, Naylor. Going up against the 2018 champ representing the Yes Guy, No Guy Conference, the number one seed in that conference this year, and again, the 2018 champ.
Mac Jameson? I want to hear the beginning again, because I guarantee if I hear the guy's voice, I'll tell you who it is.
All right.
Is this Brian?
This is Brian.
Noodles! I quit the show!
All right, go to TSN1050.ca, click on Sound Wars, and vote for your ultimate champion. They did it, Naylor, from last year, or this year's champ, Mac Jameson. Voting for this Sound War closes tomorrow at 8 a.m., and listen to Landsberg in the morning to find out who will be the Sound Wars ultimate champ for the summer of 2018. Only right here on TSN 1050. The Duke Blue Devils are in town for a rare appearance. They're at Ryerson tonight. Jay Billis is in the house calling the game for ESPN. He will join us to give his take on Duke, college basketball, RJ Barrett, who's a Toronto kid. That's coming up to kick off the 5 p.m. hour.